This is the United States Eventing Association's official podcast. Hello and welcome to episode 222. I'm Chris Stafford, and on this final episode of 2018, we'll be hearing from the current USEA president, Carol Kozlowski, and the president-elect, Max Corcoran. I spoke to both of them at the 2018 annual convention in New Orleans earlier this month. First, Carol reflects on her 2 years of presidency so far and looks forward to 2019 and what she has on her agenda. We'll then hear from Max Corcoran to get her reaction from taking over the role from Carol, which will be in Boston at the 2019 convention. Max also talks about her career so far and how that will help her with this new responsibility in sports governance. Carol, we've talked before, I think it was 2 years ago, about what your vision was. Let's review those 2 years.
It's been a really wonderfully rewarding time for me. I won't pretend it's not a lot of effort, a lot of time at the computer, a lot of time on conference calls, but really the people that I've had the chance to work with have been really it's heartwarming. It really is wonderful to see our organization and have these wonderful people to work with.
Well, of course, you shadowed Kira in the past.
Diane Pitts,
yes, I beg your pardon.
Right, yeah.
Diane Pitts there for a year, so
yes,
you were the lady in waiting, so you got a chance to have a sense of what the responsibilities were. Is it anything and everything that you expected?
Oh, that's funny. Yes, I would say I was very fortunate because I'd been on the board. I did 2 terms on the USEA Board of Governors, and so I was very familiar watching some excellent people precede me in the president's role. And as I said, I could only hope to emulate the job they did leading the organization. But it has been everything I expected, you know, thorns and all, bumps in the road and all. Yeah.
What have you most enjoyed and what have you been most sort of anxious about in terms of, you know, checking those boxes over the 2 years of what you've wanted to achieve?
Well, I think that certainly we're never satisfied with, I'm going to say, the level of safety. With, you know, to me, one of the most rewarding aspects of my 2 years is watching this ongoing focus that we've had on cross-country safety and really the continuing, the accelerating research and development, certainly of our frangible technology, but also coinciding with that, our course designers are getting better and better in how they how the questions that they're asking these horses. You know, you can't just make the jumps bigger and harder and you know, kind of the make the efforts harder in that regard. In fact, today when they Mark Phillips and his group did a session on course design, they are really taking into account the horse's vision. And you know, the just things that 10, 15, 20 years ago we had not really fully considered. Our statistics keep improving. But you know, and we keep going to this kind of this old familiar saying, our sport will never be completely safe. But what we're trying to do and the efforts, the focus has been really rewarding to watch. What we're trying to do is make it as safe as possible and really try when a horse or a rider makes a mistake, try our very, very best to have that not be a fatal mistake.
Well, absolutely. And we all know that welfare is the most important thing. What do you think we've achieved in those 2 years? Or how much further have we come in terms of the welfare and the safety then?
We have a cross-country safety, we used to be called a task force, it's now a committee. And they have now developed a testing device to make sure that our frangible devices are firing, you know, that we can have all the best intentions of the world in the world, but if they are not always dependable And we did have a failure of a device to release this year at an event in the spring. And so we have now developed a testing device. So we keep really taking this very, very seriously that we're going to try to marry the concept of testing our athletes at whatever level they're competing at, testing them vigorously. But I'm very proud of our trend toward really protecting our competitors.
Well, all important, of course. And I know one of the things that you've been passionate about during your tenure is to encourage grassroots and to focus on the grassroots riders, because that's the base of the membership here at the USEA. Talk a little bit about that, Carol, and where do you think you've come with that mission?
Well, right from the work that the office and the staff is doing, I really think that the focus of our organization has really done a great job over the last couple of years of recognizing how important our lower level, our amateur riders, as you said, the grassroots, they really comprise the majority of our membership. And so not to take away from the successes of our upper level riders, just to make sure, to me, the kind of the feeding and care of our lower level members that are so important. They're the base of our pyramid, and to make sure that they feel valued, they feel like they're getting what they want from this sport, and they have representation, and they have the competitions they want. You know, our American Eventing Championship has grown by leaps and bounds, and they comprise from beginner novice through training, they comprise 2/3 of that championship. Yeah. We're really, really trying to again, that's been one of my focuses, give the amateur rider the opportunity to feel valued.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, we all know for them, the AECs is their Olympics, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Absolutely. And so again, another thing that I'm very proud of is we're seeing a continuous trend upward in our Classic 3-Day. And in the United States, this is, to me, is amusing. The United States is the only country in the world that has preserved that format. It is gone across the rest of the world. But in America, it is growing at the lower levels, as our riders, our lower level riders, again, that is their Kentucky. That is their ultimate goal. They're recognizing the value of a long format event as being, you know, the pinnacle of effort for that level. And these events keep growing and growing, and we're the series keeps getting bigger. And obviously, it's an educational series, so that in itself is useful. We're spreading the word in horse care and management and this and that. But the Classic 3-Day just keeps getting more and more popular. That's really cool.
Do you think we've come full circle then?
Oh, I don't know about full circle. I think that we've actually changed tactics in a manner that no one expected 15, 20 years ago. You know, certainly it was bad news, and the Americans did fight this. When the FEI made the decision to abandon the long format, the Americans were the last to accept it. We fought it as hard as we could, and clearly we were going to be left out of the international scene if we didn't embrace it. And so it was really ironic, because the concept of having a novice level 3-day never occurred to anyone 20 years ago. And now we have, 8, 10 across the country that are very well attended. So in a manner, we have come full circle, but we've created a different stage, a different platform.
Yeah, it's very interesting how the sport is evolving, isn't it, and
it
how
really
popular
is.
That has been.
Yeah.
The other thing I want to talk about is the volunteer program, because that really has flourished.
It really has. And again, you mentioned the focus that I've brought to my presidency of the amateur, you know, the grassroots rider. To me, the other half of that equation is recognizing everyone behind the scenes who makes these competitions happen. And you know, the riders, the professionals, little slow, but we're gathering steam. They're starting to understand the importance that the volunteer has in competitions. But the growth of, you know, the volunteer incentive program, you know, just the whole focus on making those people that are involved in our competitions feel like they're part of the team, You know, they're not there just as labor. They are really part of the team, along with the officials and the organizers, to really make the competition flourish. And it's really so wonderful to see these programs grow.
Yeah, and they're kind of a rewards program, isn't it?
Absolutely, you know? Yeah. And really, the concept of not just giving them, saying thank you and feeding them for the day, but making them understand that, kind of on a larger scale, that we need you to feel valued, and we want to reward you for your investment, for your time and energy in our sport.
Yeah, it really is fabulous, and it's lovely to see them recognized.
Absolutely.
Here at the convention.
Yeah, it's so much fun. Yeah, yeah.
Well, let's look forward to the next year. One more year to go, Carol. What's on your to-do list?
Oh, boy. Well, I'm excited. We do have a president-elect that will be coming in to shadow me, much like I did with Diane Pitts, and I'm going to save that nugget for Christine for another announcement. But at any rate, we will continue forward. You know, we have got a number of programs up and running. I early on in my presidency, I was a huge supporter of the LandSafe program of Danny Warrington and his wife Kelly. And we will continue. I look forward to continuing, backing that his efforts as far as our safety goes. We're looking at let me back up a little bit here. The board decided last year to award our American Eventing Championship to the Lexington Horse Park. And the group there, Vanessa Coleman, EEI, and Mary Fike, they put together a dynamite team. And I can't tell you how excited I am that we are headed to Kentucky for our eventing championships in 19 and 20. Yeah, it's
yeah.
Going to be huge.
Yeah, and they have an option of a third year, I hear.
Actually, no. It's not an ironclad contract, in meaning that we've left our third year open with the hopes that we can return west of the Mississippi again. We're not, we haven't selected a site yet. Obviously, this year we went to the Colorado Horse Park, and that was hugely popular. It was hugely successful, and so we're looking to do that again if we can make it work. So 2 years at Kentucky, and then the third year, hopefully we're going to go west again. We're going to try to make it work.
Okay, so what else is on your agenda then? Because you must be sort of excited and kind of a little bit of a real relief that the responsibility will be over in a year?
That's
or
really
I mean,
funny.
Is it mixed feelings?
So I have experienced, I'm going to say, four former presidents. And I always wondered at their giddiness, at the close of their presidency, they would all kind of dance off the stage and go merrily on their way. And now I get it. But I'm looking forward. I have to say my clients, my students, I am a professional. I do teach. They've been so patient. They've been so understanding of what I've been doing. I don't have a lot of spare time, and frankly, they would take the brunt of it. Conference calls several a week. I have a lovely young horse that I'm looking forward to developing, and so I obviously my participation will change a bit. I will go on to the USEF committee, much as Diane did. I will step into. So we don't go away. We get recycled. Everybody moves their chairs around the table, but I am looking forward to a little more spare time. Yeah, it'll be good.
Yeah, I like that idea.
Everyone's been very patient with me, and it's good.
I like that idea of you being recycled, because we know from Joe Whitehouse,
Exactly, right. Yeah.
And then you go on to do other things, which is great because of the experience and the knowledge that you have, Carol, and what you've brought to this over the last 2 years.
There's so many different perspectives to the issues that we face in our sport, and I can't tell you how many times I've rethought what I thought I had a very firm opinion on, and I thought, well, I didn't have enough information. Yeah, so it's good. It's really, and it's a much healthier way to view things.
Can you summarize in what your biggest takeaways will have been from this experience, and what you might put in a journal at the end of the day?
Oh boy, we have some amazing people in our sport. And at the end of the day, I think everyone is working toward a common goal of, as you said, welfare and fair play. And I will right now give a shout out. We have an incredible staff. I mean, the staff in the USEA office and our CEO, Rob Burke, you could not ask for a better person to have heading things up. So my takeaway is that I think our sport is in good hands. I think that we are headed in a very positive future. I think, though, that our sport will continue to morph. Our culture is changing. The reality is that we are losing access to land. I think it will be a little bit different in the future. But I am really, really encouraged. We have such good people and such bright minds addressing these issues. You know, there's nothing really. It's certainly not just throwing things to the wind and hoping for the best. A lot of careful thought and analysis goes into everything.
Well, you know, it's well known that in the White House, when the outgoing president leaves, he leaves a note on the desk in the Oval Office. What will your note be to the new president?
I think probably I will tell her to trust her gut, trust her instincts. You know, you learn to listen. You learn to listen to people, and kind of everyone has something that they can add to, when you're evaluating situations, and you learn to amalgamate just a lot of different points of view. And I think that I have every confidence in our incoming president that she will be very good at it. It's a fascinating ride, and it's an opportunity to have an impact. And I'm lucky because as a competitor, as a coach, as a teacher, I'm in the trenches, and so I can listen and hear and react to and be a good ambassador. And I think that's really kind of my role has been to be an ambassador and to listen to our membership, and that will be probably my note to my successor is just keep your ears open but trust your gut.
Well, it's also an honor to serve a sport.
And you know, it is. It means that some people that are in a position to make these decisions have trusted you with representing the sport, you know, not just with the leadership skills. I mean, my job, really, I run the meetings, but really the delegation is huge. What I do is I encourage our board to work as a team, and everyone has a voice. I certainly am not steering things. You know, it's certainly not my agenda that we're following. And I think it's important that people know that they do have a voice and they will be heard. But certainly that's what's coming from the board.
What would you like your legacy to be? What would you like to be on that plaque when you retire?
I think that having the courage. You know, obviously, I stuck my neck out years ago on a national and international level and took on kind of a big issue. And I think having the conviction and sort of the fortitude to maintain your posture, your profile or whatever, in front of a group that may or may not be friendly, and you know just learning to be a good facilitator. You know, just so I don't know if that's a legacy for me, but I think that sort of a willingness to hear everyone and to go forward, as I said, trying to represent the majority as best I can.
Well, we look forward to the future, and I hope that we'll have this conversation next year,
yeah.
Carol, and then we'll review your 3 years and what it looks like for the new president.
Sure. Yeah, that'd be great. I look forward to it.
Thank you.
Be dancing out the door. There we go.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris.
Well, Max Corcoran, you've just been named as the president-elect of the United States Eventing Association. Well, first of all, my friend, congratulations. How does that feel to have that responsibility bestowed upon you in a year's time?
Well, thank you, Chris. It's a bit overwhelming, quite honestly. There's a lot of big, important footsteps to follow in. I've got some big shoes to fill. There's been some of the great leaders of our sport have done this. So it's really an honor. It's overwhelming. And I hope I can do a good job following in their path.
Well, obviously, you've got a great deal of support, I know, and a lot of people out there that haven't been at the convention, a lot of the members will probably maybe not know you. There's some, you know, even though we think most people know Max Corcoran by now. But let's start with a little bit of background and where it all began for you and why you chose eventing as your career path.
Well, I started riding in, I grew up in Manchester, Massachusetts, and I started riding, taking riding lessons when my best friend in fifth grade was taking riding lessons, and then that was great, and then I moved on to ride at Tim and Jane Murray's, Tim's mom's place, Patty Murray, at Pine Grove Stables, and that was really, really fun. We had a great group of sort of girls that were between the age of, I don't know, at that time, what was I, probably 12, between 12 and 18, and we were all sort of pals together, and we would spend the weekends there together, and we would just be barn bums for the weekend, and, you know, we'd Friday afternoon riding lessons, and then we'd just sort of hang out. She did a lot of fox hunting up at the Myopia Hunt, and she was fantastic. She taught us all a lot of discipline and in conduct, and she, you know, when you're out in the hunt field, there, you know, obviously there's certain etiquette, and, you know, make sure you're dressed correctly and say good morning to everybody, and she was fantastic with all of us that way, and we all had to work hard. I you know, my family can't, I come from a totally non-horse family, and so I had to work to afford the riding, so I would get there early and get all the horses tacked up for the hunt, and off we would go. We would have a great time, and Bobby Costello was there. As a, he was sort of the, he was a bit older than us. Not too old, Bobby, don't worry. But he was, you know, when you're 16 and he's 20, you know, it's a 4-year age gap, but that back then that's a big age gap. But he was doing some eventing, and we all thought that was great. And Groton House was there, and that was a huge event then in the calendar. And that was sort of everybody's goal, was to get to Groton House. And so there was times when I had pretty rotten borrowed horses that I did my very first. Actually, I did my very first event at a fantastic place called Shepley Hill. A nice woman that had let me ride one of her horses when she had two, and she was a professional, my friend Barbara Brown. She had two horses, and she was kind enough to sort of let me groom for her and give me a horse to ride, because she worked for at a big corporation, and so that was great. And so that's where it all started. I got bit by the bug then, and so carried on with that. But then I went to, you know, I didn't ride through high school too much, only in the summers. And then I went to university at Northeastern, and I played ice hockey there. So again, the horses were there, but I wasn't really all that involved with them too much, because I was trying to finish school and play hockey and do that. But I spent my summers working for Bobby Costello and Mark Donovan, grooming for them. Spent a lot of time doing that, which was awesome.
So the grooming then, was that something fundamentally that you invested in, and you invested in the learning of the grooming, right, but more than the riding?
Absolutely. I mean, in some ways it became, because that was how I could afford to ride, was for me to look after the horses, and then I wanted to know more about them, and then I wanted to learn more, and I thought the vets were cool, and then I met Jack Marr, who is, if anybody who does not know who Jack Marr is, please look him up, because he was an absolute genius when it came to kinesiology, physiology of a horse and their muscular skeletal and their muscles and how they move and why they move. And I remember I saw him watch a horse walk away, and he's like, oh, that right shoulder, look how stuck it is. And I thought, what the hell is this old man talking about? And sure enough, he took his time, and he showed me, and it was his kindness that sort of got me to think a little bit more about that. And then Dr. Marty Simonson was there, and again, he is a person that took just a little extra time and treated everybody the same, and would have a moment, and he'd say, well, what are you looking for? And he's like, well, come here, girl. And he'd sort of stand me in front of him, and he'd say, you see this? This is what we're doing. And he taught me how to pick up a leg and touch it and stuff, and then I wanted to know more, right? So it's just those people, and you don't, you know, you at the time you're like, oh, well, that was kind of cool. You look back at it now, and those are the people that got you into passionate about wanting to do more and know more. And, you know, if you take that little bit away from those people, that's sort of where the passion comes from.
And then, of course, the opportunities came about to groom, you know, for more high-profile riders at higher levels. You were clearly smitten that grooming wanted to be your career, but were your parents ever thinking, oh, gosh, maybe that's not the life for you if they weren't horsey?
Well, absolutely. They kept saying, oh, when are you going to get a real job? When are you going to get a real job? And, you know, it took a long time for my parents to sort of understand what it was that I was doing. I worked for Mike Plum, and I did my 4 years of school, and then I worked for Mike Plum, which was... I loved every minute of it. I learned so much from that man. He was tough but kind and thankful, and you know, he demanded a lot, but that was the world, right? It's like you're there to do a job, and he taught me a lot as a horseman. He taught me a ton that it was, you know, what my job was. I remember him saying to me one time, I had a horse that was dancing around on the cross ties a bit, and he said, you need to take extra time and make this horse stand still in the cross ties. I was, oh, okay, yep. He says, if that can't stand still in the cross ties, how am I going to get him to stand still at X? I thought, right, okay. So with that bit of thing, I said, well, you know, I guess my job's actually really important to what Mike's doing. Like, my work in what I do on the ground with these horses transfers over to what he's doing. And so he actually relied on us to do that, to, you know, if that horse had a particularly tough day, it was up to us to make sure the horse was looked after correctly, you know. So for sure that was great. But yeah, again, mom kept saying, oh, when are you going to get a real job? And so I went and did the real job. I went and got a job in downtown Boston. I worked for an investment company, went from one company to the next because I was offered a better job there. And I, you know, I loved it. I liked a lot about what I did. I commuted into Boston on the train. That was a totally different life. I would, you know, have my newspaper and my cup of coffee and my bag, and I'd walk to the train station and spend my 45 minutes on the train and, you know, read the paper every morning. That's something I don't get to do much anymore. But it was great. And, you know, the commute got to me, and I sort of started to really miss being outside and miss being part of that. And so... But in that period of time, I actually purchased my first horse. Wasn't very expensive, but I had enough money to be able to afford to board the horse and do all that, which was actually very cool. And then as that time rolled along, I just sort of got itchier and itchier to be outside. I was going to work in the dark and coming home in the dark, and that was really tough. So I ended up, I'd gotten to be good friends with Jim Stamets, who is, you know, we miss Jim so much. He was just such a great guy, a great trainer up in Hamilton, and a great rider, a fantastic rider. Really never got to reach his potential, but he ran the Gathering Farm up in South Hamilton, Massachusetts, where the old team headquarters used to be on Bridge Street. And I got to be friends with him, and he said, oh, quit your job, come work for me, quit your, he kept saying, always joked, quit your job, come work for me. I was like, Jim, no, I can't afford it. And he's like, no, quit your job, come work for me. And I said, no, I can't do this. I said, you can't afford it. And so he said, and one day he came and he said, you try me. I said, well, I need this, and I need this, and I need my horse paid for it. And he goes, right, done. I said, oh, damn it. So, I thought, okay, well, I guess I better quit my job. And so that was in February, and I went to start working for him in March. We had such a great time. He's just was a really good horseman. Again, learned so much from him. He had a couple horses. My horse wasn't very sound at the time, so I didn't travel too much with him, but I traveled with Jim a bunch and with Fabulous Ballymar, who the John and Diane Pingree own, who are, I owe them a world of gratitude. They were great. So Jim had a great year. The horse won a lot. You know, just did very, very well. And he was just having, you know, a great time because finally he was getting some recognition that he deserved. He was so busy teaching everybody else that he didn't have time to actually get on his horse. So I would make sure that I would have that horse tacked up and bring it down to him and be like, you got 10 minutes, get on it, right? And so I could do that for him and keep the schedule and keep his balance really, really well. So that was super. And then he unfortunately had a heart condition, and he went to bed with his dogs in November 17th and didn't wake up. And so that, you know, again, a great way to go if you're gonna go. But I left Ballymar sort of in limbo because she wouldn't have been the easiest horse to manage and look after. Again, she taught me a ton. And then the John and Diane Pingree came to me and said, we're going to send Bally down to Karen O'Connor. I said, wow, that is so cool. I said, well, yes, she and Jim were working students together at Tad Coffins, and wouldn't that be, you know, we just think that's the right thing to do. And, you know, I called Karen and she's all excited, but here's the deal. We want you to go with her. I thought, Okay. So I packed everything up and went there, and rest is history.
Well, it certainly is well known, of course, your partnership there with Karen and David, and the many horses that you groomed, the great horses that went on to win medals and Olympic Games, World Championships, Pan American Games. Of all of those trips that you did, there must be some career highlights, and if you could summarize that for us, Max.
Well, it's funny. I mean, people, some of the horses that actually kind of sometimes are your favorites are the ones that nobody really knows about, right? I mean, it's actually interesting. They're not the famous ones, but for sure they all have a big place in your heart because you spend so much time with them and you end up being their person, you know, and that is really special. And, you know, it was funny. My mom came down, but maybe my third or fourth year working for Karen and David, my mom came down for Christmas and we went, I took her riding and she, you know, because she had done, you know, a little bit here and there, but I can't remember who she rode, some quiet horse, put her on, we went for a ride. And so she walked through the barn and she saw all the setup and everything and recognized my handwriting on a lot of the things, which is terrible, but because I have really bad handwriting. And she said, so let me get this straight. These people buy a horse. I said, yep. And she said, and they want Karen and David to ride the horse. I said, yes. And you're in charge of everything else for them. I said, yes. And she's, that's a really important job. I was like, yes, you know, she gets it. And she's like, wow, so you're in charge of like their travel and their food and when the vet comes and what they eat, how they're exercised and what happens after. I said, yes, Mom, that's what I do. Okay, I get it. I was like, excellent, she gets it. You know, conversation's finally done. However many years later. So yeah, that was cool. But yeah, the horses they're just amazing. All those, you know, the first when I first got there, I was given three horses to look after, and on top of Ballymar, I had Joker's Wild, who was a very, very cool horse, and a little horse named Q. I can't even remember what his real name was, and then another one, little one named Cedric, and they were sort of mine to look after. That first winter I was working for them, and Joker had been an interesting horse because he had been injured, had a bad fetlock and had been injured a bit, and shockwave therapy had just come out and sort of just restarted his career again, and people didn't believe in him, but I believed in him because I didn't know not to believe in him because I'd only met the horse, and what a cool horse. And he went on to keep going and going and do great things and won Karen her first individual medal. And so that was very, he was a very special horse. Obviously Ballymar was a very special horse because she represented so much. And Upstage is a very cool horse because he was such a fighter and such a, he is because he's still with us, as is Joker. You know, and he's just a tough, they're, you know, just such cool horses in their own right. I mean, obviously the great Theodore O'Connor was, you know, a pretty cool story, and he was very famous, and that was a lot, you know, still a lot of pressure to have him in your barn, and he was tough to look after because he was so incredibly quirky, and so you always had to be one step ahead of him. But you learn so much for every single horse that you look after, and you can take whatever you've learned from them to the next one. Even, you know, I got to be around Gilt Edge and Biko and Prince Panache and Custom Made, and Mandiba was very important to me. He is still important to me because I was there when he got broke, right through the Olympic Games and the World Championship, so that's pretty special. You know, so there's, you know, and then, you know, of course, Mr. Medicott. I mean, I have such a crush on him. And then there's Veronica, and she's so cool. And then there's, you know, a little horses like A Far Cry, and, you know, so many others that just, you know, Hugh Knows, and I could, list could keep going of just these cool horses that I was around, the One Step Closer, that ended up back with the Hewletts, and, you know, they all have their things with them that make them really special and really cool in your heart, but you remember all of them. Yeah.
Yeah, well, you do, and you take something from all of them. But during that time with the O'Connors, of course, you established yourself as an international groom, we want to say, you know, and someone who was passionate about the standard of horsemanship and how important that is. And it's become an educational tool for you now. And I want to fast forward to where you are now, because since you left David and Karen, you've been campaigning in a way, in ways where you've been, you know, giving back to the sport and motivational speaking and in the message that you have for horsemanship, right? And championing people and encouraging people to learn about horsemanship and how important it is in the sport. And this is something that we, I think, generally talking to the membership here and their reaction to you being named as president-elect, that you will bring to your presidency here with the USCA. What do you feel that is important about that that will contribute to the growth of the USCA and its educational program?
Well, I mean, as we know, the mission statement for the USCA is education, is to educate people about the sport, and I think that's actually a really big deal. And I think horsemanship a little bit has been lost. Obviously, the loss of the long format is one reason, but I also think, too, now that these riders are having to make a living, it's a little bit tougher for them to pay their bills. Everyone's buying farms and having families and stuff, so people are spending so much time riding and not so much time coaching. They're teaching, but they're not coaching. And I find coaching to be more of a broader spectrum of, the management of those horses and everything. People come in, have a lesson, they leave. You know, and they don't, you know, the instructors don't have the time to say, hey, you know, maybe your horse is a bit lighter. Hey, why is your horse wearing bar shoes? Or hey, your horse looks a little sore in his left hind. They don't have time to do that because they got to get on to the next, right? So I think there's a bit of a lost art there to the management. And you can see it, unfortunately, it goes right up to the top. I mean, our country has a very, very high attrition rate with top horses. And, you know, it's interesting, you look at Fair Hill or some of these other 3 days, you have 110 two-star horses, and then 1 year later you have 40 three-star horses. So, you know, what's happened to those horses? Maybe they're horses that should never go three-star. Maybe they get sold to be, they're supposed to be fantastic young rider horses, and that's great. That's what they're supposed to do. So you give that a little bit of a balance. But really to look at it that way, you're going, well, that's a fair change. You know, maybe some horses have moved up to the four-star level, they're a Burley or whatever, but still I think to look at it that way is still a big change, big number. And so there's, you know, even you go to the competitions and you just see, you know, just, and again, it's not for people being ignorant. They don't know what they don't know. And I think a little bit that way, and I hate to say it like that, but again, people aren't being coached and people are hungry. They're thirsty for knowledge. They want to know more. They want to figure it out. So I think, you know, I think a lot of it is the mindset of, I think our culture right now, especially in eventing, is it's not very kind. I think people need to be kinder to each other. People need to support each other. So people need to help each other out and ask questions and ask for advice and open our minds and watch and learn and do. I think we're missing that a bit. You know, if somebody has a stop on cross country, it's instead of being like, oh shoot, well that's too bad, you know, you catch up with like, oh, you okay, I'm sorry you had to stop on cross country, right? The reaction for most people is you're like, oh did you see that person had to stop, right? So I think we need to be kinder to each other and encourage each other and help each other. I was like, oh, that's too bad, have you, you know, oh, I was getting run off with, I couldn't stop. It's like, oh well, you know, did you try a different bid, you want to try this? And people need to have their minds, you know, to be nicer with helping each other out. I think our world in general, the entire world, is so mean and throwing backstabbing that I feel like we should be better. If that makes sense.
Well, absolutely. And I think, you know, that's a great philosophy to bring to the USCA's presidency. I mean, there's a lot of other things, of course, that make up the USCA, not just, of course, the horsemanship that you'll bring to it and that standard and the coaching and the education side of things. There's the membership. There's a lot of turning wheels at the same time. Do you have an eye on the other important aspects to boost the membership, to boost the entries at national level? We've looked at the figures today in the meeting. Give us a sense of all the other things that are important to you and where you feel your focus will be, as well as in horsemanship.
Well, I think the grassroots level for sure is going to be a good way, you know, is going to be an important thing. I think, you know, there's a lot of unrecognized competitions that are happening now, and to be able to work with those competitions to keep them, first of all, keep them safe and organized correctly and monitor correctly, and then to attract those people to be part of, why do they want to be part of the USA? Well, let's give them something to be a part of, right? Everybody wants to be a part of something, so let's give them something to be a part of. You know, I think, unfortunately, our numbers are down this year because we lost 29 competitions to rain. So unfortunately, I think financially we hurt a little bit that way. But in it's trying to figure that out. There's obviously the safety thing is always going to be on the forefront, membership for sure on the forefront. But I think there's cool things like the the new Event Horse program. I think that actually is a program that I didn't even know about until this year when I was sitting in the Board of Governors meeting, which is a competition for horses in their first year of eventing. For the thoroughbred that's just come off the track, or a dressage horse that's doing his first horse trials. And, you know, that's actually kind of a cool thing. And that's another great way for people to get into the sport and to be part of it. I think the more we can encourage, you know, the young event horse and the future event horse, stuff like that. I would love to see the future event horse and the young event horse work together. I feel like the committees have the same vision, but they aren't looking down the same tunnel. But it would be nice if they could do that, because one should lead to the other to produce young, nice, really good horses in this country. But there's so many, when it comes to the finances, that's a whole bunch of numbers I don't understand. but you know, obviously there's a lot to it that's out there, and, you know, and to continue keeping our relationship with the USEF, and finding out what we can do for each other to help the sport.
Well, we had, you know, continually the welfare of the horse is paramount, of course, and everything that we can do in terms of making sports safer. It'll never be risk-free, but safer. And we've heard over the course of this convention how, expertise, what they're bringing to this and to help. And we've also heard a little bit, and we'll hear more about safe sport, and this is at a period where culturally we're much more aware. This is not something that this sport is leading. It's coming from the International Olympic Committee down to the National Olympic Committee and the governing bodies and national federations. In terms of how you feel your role as a presidency in this particular moment in history, Max, and I know we've got a year to go before your presidency begins, but what do you feel, given your background, your involvement in the sport, how do you feel that this will play an important part in this moment in history?
It's a really good question, Chris. I mean, I think we've seen this whole Me Too movement that's gone on, and I think we've, unfortunately, I feel like the women who have come forward, who truly are victims, have been getting a lot of press and a lot of attention, and I think it has caused a lot of other people to come forward that maybe aren't victims, and they're a little bit abusing the system in my eyes. I think there are very, very legitimate situations that have happened where people have been a little bit bullied, a little bit harassed by a bigger, if I don't do X, Y, and Z, I won't get this job. Or if I don't do X, Y, and Z, my future is over. If I don't do X, Y, and Z, I won't get the attention. So I can see there's legit parts of that. But in the end, too, I think people need to be fair and to take that away from someone that truly has been abused, I think, is cruel. But rolling that into the safe sport thing, unfortunately, I think this is a massive knee-jerk reaction from what we saw what happened with the gymnastics. And it happens apparently a lot in swimming, I've been told, and a lot in dancing. And I'm hoping that this initial burst is a knee-jerk reaction to set a standard. But at the same time, I feel like, as a woman, I think we're going to get a lot better deal on this, which I have a lot of friends that are men that I know are fantastic people, and you just don't, you know, what happened to them 15 years ago should not affect who they are today. I think people a little bit haven't had a fair shake of that. I think it's going to be interesting to set some guidelines. I think the men are going to have to know how to protect themselves. I know a lot of the male riders, John Holling, John Elliott, Matt Brown, I'm just like naming a few that I've talked to a little bit about this. They all have students that are under the age of 18. And then they said, I don't want to drive in a truck with them. They're under 25. I don't want to drive to an event in a truck with them by myself. I just don't know. And that's not right. That's not right. That's really difficult. And so for them to be put under that kind of pressure isn't really very fair. So in the end, I mean, I think this whole safe sport thing, I know there's someone that's going to speak to us here at the convention about that and hopefully set some sort of guidelines and help people figure out what is appropriate or, you know, at the end of the day, it's your mama didn't teach you right. You know, it's such a strange thing, but I just don't know. I just hope it I mean, yes, there is a place for it, for sure. I just think right now it's a little too big, and I hope it does quiet down and we do get to protect the people that need to be protected.
Well, let's look forward to then this next year. From now on, for a year, you're going to be serving as the lady-in-waiting to
yes.
the present president, yes. Carol Kozlowski, apprenticing, shadowing her, learning about the job. What are you most looking forward to?
The next, for 4 years to come? No, I think there's a lot to learn. And obviously, Carol's been amazing. And I know Carol for years from Area 1. And I think I feel very comfortable around her, and I know she's gonna you know help me out as much as she can. So I'm looking forward to working with her because I think she's awesome. I'm looking forward to just understanding more about you know working with the staff. The USA staff they're just incredible people. They work tirelessly. Because it is a nonprofit, you would love to give them you know bonuses and bigger paychecks all the time, but they just are so, and they love the sport, and that's why they're here, you know, working so hard for us. Working with them, learning more about what happens at the USCF level, working with Rob Burke. I think Rob Burke is such a great leader for that group. So there's lots to look forward to. I think it's, you know, it's exciting, it's terrifying, it's everything. So hopefully the year will go by slowly. This year will go by slowly. The next three will go by quickly. So that could be, it's all exciting. It's very exciting.
It's a very exciting time in your career, of course. And finally, a message to the members.
Oh, you got to throw that on me. I hope the members feel comfortable to come and talk to me about whatever it is that they feel that they want to know more about or be a part of or have concerns or questions or anything like that. People can always get in touch with me. And, you know, I look forward to being the president, and I hope I do a good job for them.
Well, we're very much looking forward to it. Wish you the very, very best of luck with it. And, you know, congratulations again, and we look forward to the next 4 years.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Chris.
And that's a wrap for 2018. I want to thank all of our guests this year who've made this podcast possible. And we hope that you've enjoyed it, and we'll be back in the new year with a lot more guests to talk about the sport of eventing in this country and beyond. And we have some new segments that we'll be introducing too. So we're all looking forward to that. In the meanwhile, we want to wish you a very happy new year. We'll see you in 2019. In the meanwhile, thank you for listening wherever you are in the world, and enjoy your eventing.